What is poetry for?
Poetry, I would say, and being a poet, is a serious way of attending to what it means to exist in a time and space when there are many forces that would want to erase one from here. So it reminds you to be rooted.
That's Aishan Hutchinson. Later in the show, we talk with him about his lyrical collection of essays meditating on history, colonialism, memory, and poetry. But first, we talk with Erin Caffell about her haunting work of climate fiction set in a post-collapse New York, All the Water in the World. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice, compelling conversations with authors who challenge, inspire, and inform. Thanks for joining us this hour on this station, your favorite podcast app, or at writersvoice.net. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. When Erin Caffell began her climate fiction novel, All the Water in the World, Hurricane Sandy had just walloped New York, where she was living. 13 years later, the future she imagined seems ever closer as the Trump administration takes a chainsaw to environmental and climate protections and dismantles everything from weather forecasting to climate research to clean energy projects. What will it take to survive the collapse of civilization? A fierce fight of all against all for scarce resources? Or communities founded on solidarity and care? Caffell tells us she wanted to write something where she could imagine a future where all the worst-case scenarios had come to pass and think through on the page whether she believed there was still hope. Her story follows a family of scientists leaving a ruined American Museum of Natural History on a journey to found a new community of care. Let's listen now to that conversation. Erin Caffell, welcome back to Writer's Voice.
Oh, thank you so much for having me back.
So this novel, All the Water in the World, is such a great read. It's a speculative climate fiction novel, or cli-fi novel, taking place in and around New York City at a time in the future when the predictions we've been getting for a long time have already come to pass. So there's extreme weather, there's storms happening all the time, including something that's called a hypercane, more than a hurricane, and also mysterious diseases sweeping through the population. Government is totally gone. Communications are iffy, and technologies return to pre-industrial levels. What moved you to set a novel within this time?
Well, I was a young mother at the time that I started writing this book. I was a single mom. I had a little kid, and I had an environmental protection agency hydrogeologist mother who was doing nothing but sending me articles all the time about the state of environmental collapse. And I was working as a science journalist, writing about the fastest warming marine ecosystems on the planet. So as you can imagine, I couldn't really sleep very well a lot of the time, as I think many of us go through this sort of period if we come through an awakening about potentials for climate collapse. And I wanted to write something where I could imagine a future where all of the worst case scenarios had come to pass and set a group of people that I loved in that environment and kind of think through on the page whether I believed that there was hope for the way that humanity might respond to kind of the worst picture, the most dire picture that I had been imagining on those nights when I couldn't sleep.
So you started this a long time ago, and yet I was actually thinking that you must have at least finished this novel a pretty short time ago, because it's so prescient.
Well, I've gone through a lot of rewrites on it. I mean, one thing that I think is true about me as a writer is that I love to hop genres. I love to work in different kind of media and think about the same subject areas with different hats on. And, you know, the time I was starting to write this, I hadn't written long form fiction. I hadn't really even written fiction since college. And I really needed to learn how to write a novel. So it took me a long time to kind of go through that process, to go through the multiple iterations, multiple drafts. And so I was redrafting it right up until publication date, as you do, and visiting things about it again. But the basics of it and all of the materials that were there in the first huge run through that I did of the book, really, they felt prescient at the time, but they also felt, because I was following the science, they felt like things that might show up. And every time that a big storm would come through New York, or we'd get closer to some of the weather conditions that I was describing from, you know, theoretical models and, you know, sort of purely predictive systems that I had been reading about. Every time they came closer to being in the real world, I felt a little bit more urgency towards getting the book out, because I was like, I want to make sure that this still feels timely and still feels alive when it gets published.
Oh, boy. I mean, considering that reality tends to be even much worse than the worst predictions of the scientists, I don't think you're going to lose relevance on this novel.
No, unfortunately not. No, and even the hypercane that you mentioned at the outset, you know, this was an idea that was something I got obsessed with because it was available within the scientific imagination and the scientific data prediction of the people that were working in weather and climate that I was reading through. And people would talk about this as a theoretical possibility that might not come to pass ever. But in the last hurricane season, we got dangerously close to it. In fact, I don't know if you remember that footage of the weather forecaster crying as the big storm came out of the Gulf of Mexico towards Florida last year in the hypercharged, hyperheated ocean there. And that was because it was getting to the edges of what's possible under the sort of storm scales that we use now, and getting much closer to this thing that when I began writing about it 13 years ago was a very, very distant possibility.
13 years ago, that's when Sandy happened.
Yeah, it is. And actually, Sandy was part of the inspiration for the book, because I was born in New York City, and all of my both my parents' families were in some part of the region. My godfather was living in Brooklyn at the time; he still is. My grandmother had lived in New Jersey. Most of my family had roots at some point or another in Manhattan. And when Sandy happened, I got on the phone with my godfather, who was trying to clean up from the aftermath of Sandy. His daughter had a house in Red Hook, and he had been trying to pump the ocean out of her basement. And it was really after that conversation that this book started, because I could, for the first time, picture in a really concrete way, through the specific details that he talked about, what it would look like in this place with which I was really familiar if things went deeply awry. He talked about the way that the type of water that came in from the storm created these incredibly almost like black ice-like slicks on all of the walking surfaces, all of the paved surfaces in the city, because it was a mixture of oil and pollution and garbage and seawater. And it was that kind of specific thought process about, okay, what will it look like in this place? What are the sensory things that I would be experiencing if this happened to a city that I knew pretty well, that really made it begin to come alive for me?
Yeah. And you start the book at the old American Museum of Natural History, and talk about, I mean, a vivid scene. It is taken down by a hypercane. And for anybody who actually knows a museum, that seems almost inconceivable. It's such a sturdy structure. So tell us about the people who are in the museum and why.
Well, again, you know, because my mother was a scientist and my grandmother was a scientist, and I was raising this kid who's on a track to becoming a scientist, I really felt like the people that I knew the best, the people that I had been interviewing for my other work, the people I was really close to who weren't artists, were scientists, and were people who felt this incredible dedication to their practice, felt their practice of scientific exploration, or in certain cases, curation or maintenance of archives, as this sacred duty. And my mom and I, for fun, used to watch disaster movies that were about, you know, big volcano explosions, or, you know, like other types of natural disasters, or, you know, asteroids hitting, where the scientists got to be the heroes. And it felt very natural to me to create a community of people who were doing that work that I see done around me all the time and the people that I interact with, that I watched my mother do for her whole career, and think about again, when the disaster strikes, when the, you know, the end of sort of modern conveniences and modern scientific exploration came to pass, what would those people do with that sense of duty? What would they do with their calling? And also, I know those people really well. I know the types of nerds who get completely obsessed with a particular type of, you know, pteropod or whale, or, you know, period of natural history that they can't stop thinking about. And so it felt very natural to me to write those people into existence and to talk about what their community was like.
And just tell us briefly about some of the main characters.
Yeah, the main characters, the sort of main quartet is really just this family, a father and mother. The mother is dead when the action of the book begins, but she's very much a character in flashbacks. The mother is a scientist who does study pteropods at the museum, and she's sort of the key, literally and figuratively, that gets the family into the museum after the collapse of the city. And then the father is a curator at the Met who's interested in sort of, it's not really clear exactly what he does, but some sort of colonial furniture and design kind of curation. And they have two daughters, Bix and Noni. And it's the four of them sort of at the center of this story. But around them are all of the other people who are connected to the museum in some way. Their best friend, Keller, who is an entomologist, and then his small family as well. His wife is a librarian, and their adopted kid, Mono. And so all of these folks, they're coming from wildly different backgrounds. You know, they're coming from different parts of the country. They're coming from different countries. And then there's a sort of concentric circle surrounding them of other scientists and practitioners who are part of this community on the roof. And Noni is, at the time of the action of the book, 13, but when she's narrating, it is a few years older, and Bix is her older sister.
And Keller is Black. Talk about the racial dynamics of this time.
Yeah, you know, again, because I wanted it to feel as if someone who is a scientist or a curator who worked in museum science could pick this up and recognize what at least the moment right now looks like in terms of the diversity of voices and people who've come into the sciences, the way that, you know, there are more women in STEM and that there's racial diversity and, you know, an international diversity in most of these scientific institutions where you have people of all different backgrounds coming together to do this kind of work. It was important to me that there were Black characters and Asian characters and people from overseas and women doing this kind of work. And Keller's Black. Keller's from a family of preachers in Joliet. He comes at his science practice sideways from this very religious family. And so his life is a bit of a surprise. But when this family, who's been insulated in a community that has been very interracial, very international, very celebrating of diversity and complexity, both scientifically and personally, when they're forced to leave the community that they've built on the roof and they begin to encounter the outside world, what they find is, I think, what you find in most situations where there's been a collapse and a refugee wave, right? Where when refugee status begins to be the norm, and when there is a decentralized organization politically or governmentally, or there is no discernible government, we tend to break along religious and ethnic and racial lines. And because one of the things that you read about and study about most, if you're interested in the future possibilities of climate collapse, is what happens to climate refugees and how that plays out old tensions along religious lines, along ethnic lines, within communities that are undergoing collapse as a result of climate pressure. It felt disingenuous to me to leave out one of the greatest pressures in American life, which is our complex relationship with race and indigeneity and gender, and how those things would be baked into the aftermath of a great refugee crisis. So when they meet people, they're traveling in a group that's mixed in terms of their racial profile, but they're coming into communities that are not used to seeing that. They're used to seeing a splitting along racial lines that has come out of this pressure. And so that's something that is part of, I feel like part of Noni's coming of age story is her leaving this bubble of this beloved community where that diversity is just an everyday accepted occurrence and encountering a more hostile, more divided world outside of this place that's been made for her where she's been raised.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with Erin Caffell about her cli-fi novel, All the Water in the World. And there's definitely quite a few dystopian elements in this novel, but it's a dystopian novel that actually contrasts two different, radically different approaches to survival under these circumstances, which I think you've just kind of alluded to. There's a description in the book at one point where there are places that are made with love versus places that are made without care.
Yeah, I mean, part of this is also because, you know, I was raised not only by a mother who was an EPA scientist, but I was raised by a father who my dad discovered making Shaker furniture when I was an infant. And I was raised within his obsession where he made this furniture and studied utopian communities. We had a huge bookshelf full of all of the books that he'd read about utopias. And so, you know, I grew up with this real understanding of, like, first of all, that utopias fail, and that there is really no such thing as creating a perfected community, but the communities that thrive and survive, and even utopian systems that are constructed along these lines, ones that operate in fear, lack of love, lack of care, lack of complexity, lack of flexibility, those are the ones that fall apart most quickly. And ones that have this sort of baked in understanding of the need for change, the need for basing themselves in love of the stranger, love of the self, the empathy towards people's circumstances that bring them into the need of shelter, the need of the care of a community, those systems work. And those systems usually thrive longer. It would seem like, you know, when you're up against a dystopia, what would make sense is, like, you know, drawing the doors shut and arming the gates. But what tends to be the case is that actually, and I took some of this from the fantastic book A Paradise Built in Hell by Rebecca Solnit, which was a North Star guiding me as I was writing this book, because, you know, she did all of these sort of deep dives into the histories of catastrophes and pushing back against this myth that what we have in a catastrophic environment is this human instinct to loot or to enact violence that we've just sort of built up and been waiting to unleash. And that actually it's communities of care that spring up in the face of disaster, and protection and retention of what's important, either physical objects or human beings, or, you know, even just practices of care of making sure that people have medicine and food and shelter, even if they are the stranger. And so I wanted to talk about the way that people break along this internal ideology, right? Of, like, what is going to keep me safe in the crisis to come? Is it going to be more control, higher panic, higher fear, or is it going to be more openness and love and care-based construction of community?
Oh, that's so interesting, because as you were talking before about the racial dynamics, mm-hmm. I was thinking of A Paradise Built in Hell and saying, yeah, you know, people actually could work together, but these two ways of approaching can break down even into further detail. This group, this family, which has had to leave the now destroyed Museum of Natural History, are going up the Hudson River, going toward a farm that is in the family up in the Catskills, and they stop first at the Cloisters. They're given help and aid, and they are told that they have to leave by the next morning, which is interesting. And then the leader of the group of the Cloisters has a very challenging conversation with Noni's father, mm-hmm. that brings up the ethics of who does one help and who does one turn away. He's yes. basically accusing the Museum of Natural History folks of having turned people away.
Yeah, and it was also really important to me to make sure that that complexity was in there as well, because I think, you know, I didn't want to present this community that I obviously really love and care about, that I spent a lot of imaginative fuel on, as if it were a perfected place. or a place without ethical ambiguities. Because I think, you know, we do make choices when we feel like we're in crisis, even if we believe that they're really ethical choices and that they're about, you know, the people at Amen would say that their mission was to protect the collections and that nothing else really mattered, that they had to preserve their own lives and their own families in order to continue doing this sacred work and this sacred duty. And that they were protecting themselves by keeping out people who might have been dangerous or been a drain on those resources. To them, I think that that was logical. It was ethical. It fit within what they thought their mission was. But I think it is important to recognize that that's not necessarily the way that they would be viewed from the outside, and that other organizations that, you know, that did welcome the stranger, that did make a space for travelers or refugees, were operating less in fear even than our kind of our heroes, right? That you always have to think about what it is that you're doing in order to preserve this paradise that you've created. And that sometimes, and especially because I'm telling this story through the emerging consciousness of this young girl who's coming into understanding who her family is, how it operated, who her community was, how to kind of assess that against the outside world. You know, I think it was important, obviously, because I wrote it that way, it was really important to me to show that that question isn't necessarily answered in, like, there is a utopia, there is a perfectible version of this. I wanted that to be complicated. And I wanted the characters to feel like, you know, they weren't necessarily always making all the right choices in this disaster that they were facing, because I don't think any of us really can, right? When we're up against something so big, we're human. Even with the best of intentions, with the best of ideas, we're going to fail at some points, even the big questions.
And, you know, there's a question that's asked repeatedly in the book, which I just totally delighted me, because it's a question I always tell my granddaughter to ask. Mm-hmm. Noni has been taught to ask the question, why is something so, and who benefits?
Yes. I know. My parenting is showing there.
Yes. So talk about that. I mean, I think that those are the questions when somebody is saying, well, you know, why is this happening? Or, I mean, I think so many of our insanity in this country politically could have been addressed if people had been taught to ask those questions.
I think that's true. And I think that whenever you're in a community, whether that's, you know, a nation state or a political community or even a global community, or even something as small as a family, like when we're not taught to ask those questions is when we start getting into real trouble. That those are the two bases of critical thinking. And I think presenting them that way is presenting them as a lesson that Noni got from the librarian who became the teacher to the children in this community. That's something that's been drilled into her as she's been taught about what the world was like before the collapse happened. And, you know, it's something that obviously you're doing, that I was doing with my own kid. I do that with my students, because I think that is the fundamental, you know, you can blow those questions up into incredible ideological complexity, right? I studied critical theory in school, like, you know, all questions really become, you know, if you boil them down to the kid level, that's the question. Why is it so? That helps us understand cultural decisions. That helps us understand political and economic and ideological and historical decisions that have led us to that point. And it's like that great Ursula Le Guin quote about, you know, we believe that the divine right of kings was permanent, and now we believe that about capitalism. I think that as we are really wrestling, you know, I mean, obviously we're going through these incredibly divisive, horrible, painful, terrorizing questions within our own country this last few months, this last year, this last few years, that are asking that question on a really large level. The more that we're able to just invite that curiosity in and think about whether the system that we've structured is a system that is working, and who's it working for? Who does it benefit? who does the oil subsidy structure that we have to create an extractivist economy benefit? You know, doesn't benefit people who need energy to be able to run their, you know, their refrigeration or their dialysis machines or their transportation economy, right? That's not who that benefits. And I think that critical thinking question is one that is being actively discouraged within this dismantling of the education system in this country. And I think it's the one that we should start with all the time.
And the dismantling of science as well.
Yes.
Yeah. And speaking of this situation, you have a figure in the book who's referred to both metaphorically and literally, the man in the tower.
Yeah, the man in the tower. Yeah, and again, that's language that Noni creates to help her as she's coming into understanding of the great dangers of authoritarianism and violence and political control through violence. She recognizes that they stop in a place where there is literally a tower that's literally an arsenal, where people have been sent away from this small community by the threat of violence or by actually being shot from the tower. And that, you know, in a construction of a protected environment where there is a man in a tower who decides who's allowed in and who isn't through this physical violence, through this, you know, arsenal of weaponry, that's the person that you really need to begin to fear and watch out for. And that one of her coming to consciousness moments in that is not only recognizing that there is a literal man in the tower, that there is the leader of that community who sort of stands in as the metaphorical man in the tower, but then that also there's a whole structure that supports him being in that tower and the decision that's the way that community stays safe. And so, you know, it was really important to me that it wasn't just this sort of fearful patriarchal figure that could enact violence, but that also there's a character in that same community that is a very nurturing maternal character that Noni's really drawn to because she's lost her mother and she's in danger and she's been through an enormous amount of trauma, and beginning to recognize that character supports the man in the tower and makes his work possible was also extremely important to me, because I wanted this to be a book that was also complex about the ways in which, you know, many of us can become the supporters of the man in the tower, because we think we're keeping ourselves safe. We're keeping our children safe. We're keeping our community safe.
Yes, indeed. Well, Erin Caffell, finally, going back to the purpose of the group as it began in the Museum of Natural History, preserving knowledge, much like the medieval monks did in the Dark Ages. One character says, sometimes you have to remember that the world as it is changed things, but we can change them back. So this was a note of hope that one can undo the terrific damage that has been done that seems almost impossible.
Yeah, it does. It seems impossible. And I think, you know, especially living through the moment in history that we're living through here in America, where, you know, I'm constantly seeing colleagues and people I've worked with on my science writing having to literally download and preserve all of the data that's being ripped away from federal websites. It does seem impossible to imagine what's on the other side of it. But I took enormous inspiration from the stories of the curators and the archivists of the Hermitage and the related archives that were all in Leningrad, kind of connected to each other during the siege of Leningrad in World War II. And, you know, the characters explicitly talk about this as sort of a guiding principle, but that's because it was for me too. You know, that's a 3-year siege where almost everyone in the city starved to death, where there was enormous horror being enacted every day within the community that surrounded this institution. these institutions, because it wasn't just the Hermitage, which I thought about a lot, but was also, you know, that there was the world's first seed bank was located in Leningrad and was very close to the Hermitage. There was a really important archive that was right next door. And that these folks who had dedicated their lives to collecting seeds, to collecting great treasures of art history, to collecting great manuscripts, were confronted with the possibility that this was the end of the world. You know, there wasn't a guarantee when you were in the middle of the siege of Leningrad that that would be over and that the World War II would end the way that it did, with the return of democracy and the return of rule of law and the end of hostilities. And the folks who were there in that moment had to imagine what was on the other side of what they were living through. And they had to be able to retain hope that if they protected the paintings and they chipped ice off of them, and if they, you know, kept themselves alive, and repaired the windows after bomb blasts, that they were holding on for a future that they might not get to see, but that they could imagine. And I think as we confront the climate crisis and as we confront this crisis of democracy, that's what I'm trying to remember, is that if I can picture the beloved future that I want for my children and their children and for the children I don't know, if I can imagine that there is a possibility on the other side that we do repair and return and restore the destruction that's ongoing, that that's actually a deeply human drive and one that we have enacted over and over and over again throughout human history, that we're living on land where there was a horrifying genocide and ongoing for generations, that an apocalypse that people survived, kept their traditions alive, protected their artifacts, their lands in some cases, and are still here. And if we can remember those stories, I think that we can draw a lot of courage from that and turn to each other, not be isolated in the fear of like, well, it's done now. They've taken it. That's it. I don't ever want to give in to that. Because I think when we begin to, then the people who it's benefiting have actually won, and I don't want them to win. I don't believe their side deserves to win.
Well, those are really inspiring words. And this is a book that if I have to evacuate my home, I want to bring this one with me.
Oh, that's such an honor. Thank you so much. Oh.
A wonderful novel, All the Water in the World. And Erin Caffell, it's just been so great to talk with you.
Oh, it's such a delight. Thank you so much for having me back. And it's always such a pleasure to talk to you.
Erin Caffell. Go to writersvoice.net to listen to a sample from All the Water in the World. Next up, a conversation with poet Aishan Hutchinson about, among other things, memory, reggae music, and resistance. Stay tuned after the break. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Go to writersvoice.net to listen again, like, and subscribe to the podcast. Aishin Hutchinson was born in Port Antonio, Jamaica, but he spent much of his adult life away from his homeland. A National Book Critics Circle Award-winning poet, his first collection of essays, Fugitive Tilts, is a lyrical exploration of history, of home, and of poetic purpose. In our conversation, Hutchinson reflects on the weight of Caribbean colonial history, the joy and resistance of reggae music, and the poetic legacy his grandmother gifted to him. His work traces beauty through rupture and asks, what does poetry offer in a world that wants to forget? Let's listen now. Aishin Hutchinson, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thank you for having me.
You were born in Jamaica, and this collection is very much infused with your love for your homeland, as well as your recognition that the legacy of imperialism deeply determined why you had to leave. The opportunities for publication were just simply not available in Jamaica in the way that you really needed that. So this collection is very much influenced by a kind of nostalgia for Jamaica, for the West Indies. Do I have that right?
There is some amount of nostalgia there, but I wouldn't overemphasize it because I am someone who returned home quite a lot. The nostalgia that I might have is for childhood, the things that one miss because of growing up. And of course, the things one miss because one is not at home. I live for the most part in the U.S., but I do travel back a lot, a few times a year. So my condition isn't one in which I am completely bereft of home at all. But I do pine for a deeper historical knowledge and grounding of the making of my island, Jamaica, but the Caribbean as a whole. The things that I did not witness in my own lifetime, but I either read about those or somehow encountered them in different ways and wanted to sort of search through the imagination, first of all, as to what constituted the making of a place with such a history of violence and imperialism, as you said, colonialism, enslavement, a complete destruction of the aboriginal peoples of the island, and so on. So this book and overall my writing, as far as looking at home, is deeply invested in this search for what it means to be someone from a place with that kind of historical weight. It's not as always heavy as the subject matter demands. There's also a great amount of lightness, levity, and joy. Jamaican music, for instance, is one of those things formed out of the crucible of that terrible history that is such a music of fun and a music of celebration, a music that calls one to dance. So my writing, too, is interested in that passion for living and life, for the beauty of a place. Jamaica is incredibly beautiful. The Caribbean is incredibly beautiful. So in many ways, the book is a celebration of that beauty, but also keeping a close eye on the tension that comes with such a fraught history.
Well, in fact, I wanted to ask you about the connection between the music of Jamaica and your own poetry. And, you know, for many of us, the music of Jamaica is very linked to Rastafarianism, and you do come from a Rastafarian family. So connect the dots there for us. Tell us about those connections.
Yes, I was born in a Rasta household. My mother and father were Rastas. But growing up, I did not know that as such. I just thought of myself as another Jamaican kid. But there were slight differences. I had dreadlocks when I was a child and so on. Not every other kid around me had dreads. So there were little differences, but not so much a vast gulf where I thought I was somewhat different from other people. And And overall, I don't think the Rasta community is set apart in such a way. There's a sort of distinct, even just by way of look, the wearing of the dreads, for instance. Not all Jamaicans do that. So there is, in some ways, signs that make you might appear different. But psychically, or whatever it is, that kind of belonging to a Jamaican ness is it's all the same thing. The music, Jamaican popular music, emerged out of reggae in particular, emerged out of the Rasta movement in the you could probably date this to the mid 60s and at the turn of the 70s when the music was maturing. It's a music of rebellion, a music that grew out of the rhythm pattern grew out of the Rasta form of drumming called Naya Bingi, right? The Rastas would describe this music as the heartbeat music. It's a music that is a type of resistance to the colonial idea of what one should be. So it's a music of force. And it was played in the countryside with these sort of big fire, bonfire gatherings on the countryside. But that sort of traveled to Kingston. This is a very, very crude, rough sort of even reduction of how the music became, how the Rasta link to the music became so strong. But in any case, the rhythm pattern of Naya Bingi was brought to Kingston and was eventually brought into the studios, and various musicians added their own different styles and tones and different ways of interpreting that form of drum pattern. And so reggae sort of emerged out of that. What's important and crucial to the development of Jamaican music, particularly reggae, is, I had mentioned before, this theme of resistance that is running through the music. So the lyrics are usually about confronting what Rastas call Babylon, Babylon being a system of oppression. And that system of oppression, of course, is rooted in the colonial history and present of the island. So, but it also is looking beyond that. It's a deeper sort of investigation of selfhood, one's African origin, you know, questioning what it means to come from a place that one has lost touch with or has been obscured because of the experience of colonialism. So the lyrics, the force of the music is about awakening or reawakening a consciousness that that fully encourages a sense of belonging, that one is not a lost sheep in the islands of the Caribbean, but one is from a rich history and place, a continent with just great beauty. So so the reggae, Rasta music, is the kind of reminder of that story.
But you went to Ethiopia because you came because of paradise, the idea of paradise, you write, something whole yet imperfect, that you understood all your life only in terms of law. So tell us a little bit more about that connection between Ethiopia and Jamaica, which the Ethiopians also feel.
Yes, there's a strong connection between Ethiopia and Jamaica. Of course, the Rasta movement. So to say briefly, and this probably is the best way to explain Rasta's connection and or even at large Jamaica's connection to Ethiopia. So in the 1930s, when Haile Selassie, the emperor of Ethiopia, was coronated and became the emperor, many people in Jamaica recognized this important historical event as they saw it as a form of, within that context of a colonial resistance. And a couple decades before, Ethiopia was invaded by Italy. The Italians wanted to colonize that country, and it didn't happen. And so Ethiopia remained the only country in Africa not to be colonized. And this Jamaicans who were much invested in black consciousness and anti-colonial movement saw that as very significant. So just on the sort of political surface, the fact that Ethiopia resisted this European power and fought and won their and kept their sovereignty was powerful to Jamaicans and others. The deification of Haile Selassie is far too complex to get into at the moment. But my time in Ethiopia I didn't go there because of my background as a Rasta or anything like that. I really was just there because, of course, this is a place that lived in my childhood. I heard about it at Nyabingi sessions or elders just talking about Ethiopia with pride, and mostly as this place that was never colonized by Europe. And so there was this deep affection that I felt for the place and just wanted to see it. Going there, when I did, felt, there's no other way to explain it, but really felt like a homecoming, which is odd and bizarre in many sort of ways. But it's a similar feeling that I've felt every time I've traveled on the continent to different countries. It's very difficult for one myself to claim origin or root in any particular distinct place in Africa. But nonetheless, every time I am in Senegal or Nigeria or wherever, there is this sort of shock of recognition and feeling of belonging that, you know, this is home too. So that was the case for me in Ethiopia.
Aishan Hutchinson, I have to tell you that my favorite essay in this wonderful book of collection of essays, Fugitive Tilts, is the one about your grandmother. It's called Women Sweeping. It begins with a talking about a painting by the French Impressionist Edouard Vuillard. Tell us a little bit about that painting and how it puts you in mind of your grandmother. And then tell us about your grandmother. What a remarkable woman she was.
Yeah, thank you for saying that about the essay, Women Sweeping. So maybe I'll just begin with the painting, as you said. I first came across it when I was a student at university in Jamaica around 2003. And it just stuck in my mind. And I was just moved by it. Woman holding a broom in this house that seems sort of ostentatious, but also simple. And the stocky build of the woman, the way in which she felt, seems to me to just inhabit the space, that the space is her and she's the space. And I had thought of my grandmother then. Any time I come across anything that reminded me of her, I would sort of meditate on her life. You know, she was someone who worked very hard. She was a baker in rural Jamaica, and through this profession of hers was able to acquire land and build a house for her family, which some might see as something very straightforward and not that complicated. But for her and other women in her context and period of just after independence in Jamaica, Jamaica gained independence in 62, life was very, very difficult for a woman who, without education and without a family background of support, but nonetheless, she was able to forge ahead and build this incredible house overlooking the sea, which I grew up in and spent a good portion of my childhood and adolescence there under her watchful eyes. So in many ways, I attribute my becoming a poet or becoming anything in this world to her. She really led through examples, through a kind of her presence itself, never really saying much or demanding anything from me, but I felt that she was encouraging me towards pushing hard, towards reckoning with beauty, and through, you know, even through her silences and through her moments of just the way she hung clothing on the line. Sometimes I know that I might be romanticizing the work that she did, but it's a risk that I am willing to take because I witnessed it for myself. The way she would make up a tea for the day and sit relaxing in the veranda chair. You know, I was always observing these movements of hers and felt within them that they were pointing the way forward for myself. So yes, she was just this remarkable woman.
That's so beautiful. And you said she pointed you toward beauty. And beauty, of course, is such a theme in this wonderful collection of essays, the beauty of the sea, the beauty of the mountains. I'm getting the sense that she pointed you in that way because of the attention that you paid to her.
Yes, it's that, actually. As I said, the example of her life itself, I didn't know, she didn't tell me about her childhood or I had to figure out how hard it was for her. Now, it wasn't too difficult to know that it was hard for her to have gained property and build a house and so on. But I wanted to know more, but she wouldn't tell me. But through observing her, paying keen attention to her being, I think I was able to understand all she had to live through. And I felt very early on in life, through observing her, the rituals of making home and all the demands of doing so, I felt that that's what work is. That's what writing can amount to being. In that you have to really be committed to the demands of the craft. And so I was lucky and very fortunate in someone who she never slipped from doing, even up to her last moments of life on this earth. She was always sort of rooted in her purpose. And I discovered my own through observing her. And it's the great fortune of where I grew up that, like you said, the mountains behind us, the sea in front of us, you know, that kind of astonishing beauty could make a poet out of anybody. And luckily I had the great fortune of observing my grandmother at work. And when I started to think about what it is that I want to do, it happened to coincide with discovering that I love to read. And I love to write, to just make observation and write them down. And so they sort of, it happened simultaneously, really, observing my grandmother and discovering writing words. And the two are somewhat inseparable for me.
Another very affecting essay is the one about a boy that you call Lucas. And I was really struck by your observation of him. You were a child when the two of you met each other and kind of interacted with each other. And there's a cute observation you make of him because he's quite a bit of an enigma to you. He was of mixed East Indian and African descent. Tell us about him and about these two communities in Jamaica, which don't always have the easiest relationship to each other.
Yes, the East Indian community came later as indentured workers to the Caribbean, and that community settled in eastern Jamaica, where my mother is from, sort of further east in a place called St. Thomas. So that's where this essay is set, and where there are large East Indian communities. And racial relations in Jamaica has always been complex and difficult. So there, and though we were neighbors with this Indian family, we never really interacted with each other. And so it was a very strange thing when I was somewhat brought to this boy by my mother, and we had to sort of forge a relationship because we had to walk to school together. This is primary school in the early 90s in Jamaica. And we made an odd pair. This is not to say, however, that there weren't, you know, friendships and close bond and kinship between various racial groups. But growing up, for myself, I didn't always notice closeness between East Indians or even Chinese and people of African descent. And to add to it, Lucas was even more strange, as you said, a kind of enigma, because he was not strictly one or the other. He was a mixed race boy. And so I imagine for him, it was very difficult to navigate the climate of racial sort of relationship then. But yeah, we became somewhat of friends, more than that, even though it's hard to describe the relationship. There was a sort of kinship that we found in each other. And maybe that had to do with my own background, as I was explaining earlier, as a Rasta boy coming from Portland and to live in St. Thomas, where there were not a lot of kids with dreads or Rasta kids around. So maybe we recognize a kind of otherness in each other. But again, I don't want to make too much of this otherness, because it's really part of the whole sort of Jamaican milieu. It's a very, very complicated thing, and I don't think it's always worthwhile to tease one thing out and overemphasize that over the other. But nonetheless, the time spent with this boy meant a lot to me. And so this essay, I try to sort of celebrate that moment.
You know, I'd like to end our conversation in asking you, I mean, this is Poetry Month. Yeah. You know, there's one month out of the year that people celebrate poetry. I think in the United States, poetry is not as respected a genre as it is in many other countries. Talk about being a poet in the modern world, and what is poetry for?
Oh, wow. What is poetry for? Well, it's a large question. I think I would draw on something one of my mentors said, the great African-American poet Yusef Kumunyaka. And he calls poetry simultaneously confrontation and celebration. And one can say that is a confronting and celebrating of life. It is, for me, a form of resisting the pressures that come with living in a world that can be so fraught with the many difficulties that we are facing now on our political landscape and otherwise. I think poetry provides for the individual reader a space of contemplation. I like what Robert Frost had to say about that. He calls poetry a stay of confusion, right? So it puts up a shield around one and gives you time for yourself, but it does not mean that one then is cut off from the world at all. In fact, you could see it as a sort of cleaning of the lenses, right? You get to see with greater clarity what is around. And of course, that begins with a self-examination. So poetry, I would say, and being a poet, is a serious way of attending to what it means to exist in a time and space when there are many forces that would want to erase one from here. So it reminds you to be rooted.
Regretfully, we have to leave this conversation, but that's a wonderful place to stop. Aishan Hutchinson, it's been such a privilege to talk with you. I so enjoyed this collection of essays, and look forward to reading more of your poetry.
Thank you very much.
Aishan Hutchinson is the author of two poetry collections, Far District and House of Lords and Commons. He's the recipient of the National Book Critics Circle Award for Poetry and the American Academy of Arts and Letters Award in Literature, among other honors. Find a link to poems by Aishan Hutchinson at writersvoice.net. Next week on Writer's Voice, we talk with Dolan Perkins Valdez about her novel, Happy Land. It's based on a true place, one of several communities that were established by African Americans after slavery. And we also talk with Boris Fishman about his novel, The Unwanted. That's all coming up next week. Don't miss it. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Listen again for free, check out our archives, and find out more about this week's guests at writersvoice.net. You can find our social media links there too. And don't forget to subscribe, like, and link to our podcast. It really helps to spread the word about the show. I'm Francesca Rhiannon.